That's my son, Ari. He's 1 year old, and he's just learning how to talk. If you've ever been around a young child who's starting to speak, you've probably marveled at how magically words and names seem to come to them almost out of nowhere. It just happens. But what if you missed that window of opportunity and had to pick up your very first language as an adult? It happens more often than you might think, mostly in developing countries. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to stop in on a group of Kansas Cityans encountering the world of language for the first time. This story comes to us from Ari's dad, my husband, Alex Smith.
So in Bhutan, I was really young. I think I was 7 years old.
Maita is a refugee from Bhutan. Starting in the late 80s, the Himalayan country began driving out people like him, who were ethnically Nepali. They fled across the mountains to Nepal, where they were settled in impoverished camps.
I didn't even know Nepal. I didn't know anything about it.
I should explain, the voice you're hearing isn't actually Maita's. It's Jampi Biswa, who's also a Bhutanese refugee. Maita is deaf and told his story using sign language for Jampi to voice. Maita and some of the other refugees in this piece asked me not to use their last names. The countries where they lived, Bhutan and Nepal, have some of the highest rates of deafness in the world. Many people in this region lose their hearing because of a lack of basic health care to treat common ear infections, high fevers, and measles. There's also a stigma surrounding deafness, and it's common for deaf people to be kept out of public life by their families.
Some who could talk had a better life. It was different if you are deaf.
Like many deaf people in the region, Maita says he didn't go to school growing up, so he didn't learn sign language, reading, or writing. Deaf people were often stuck using informal hand gestures with friends and family and had no other way of communicating. When the Bhutanese government started pushing out the Nepalis, Maita's parents fled without him and his sister.
My other brother went with my parents, but me and my deaf sister, we were on our own.
Maita ended up living in a refugee camp in Nepal for 20 years before coming to the U.S. He eventually settled in Kansas City.
Actually, we can go around the room and they can practice. That's Dao. Her name, D-A-O, Dao.
In a small house in Kansas City, Kansas, Debbie Buchholz teaches a weekly American Sign Language class for deaf refugees. Buchholz is pastor of Deaf International Community Church. Her dozen students are almost all Bhutanese refugees. They sit in a circle of couches and watch her use sign language to introduce a new student. Dao is a woman in her 40s who looks terrified. She's a refugee from Vietnam, but her situation is similar to the others.
She has never been to school, the same as you. No school. She doesn't know sign language, nothing. You are her friends, and you know what to feel like. Refugee, you know, hard.
With their teacher's help, the class members show me how to sign their names. Maita, Guman, Don, Harka.
My name is H-A-R-K-A.
Harka, so it's two fingers on the right of the forehead.
On the right forehead.
Okay. Or at least they try to teach me. It's tricky to make the hand signs, and I get the positions mixed up. American Sign Language also has sophisticated grammar and vocabulary, but what these students are doing, learning it as a first language as adults, is really hard. And scientists are just starting to understand why.
Are you ready for your walk?
Yeah.
Can you say hello?
Hello.
That's my son, Ari. He's 15 months old and starting to learn his first language. He's saying some first words, mama, dada, hello, bye-bye. His mom and I sometimes try deliberately to teach him certain words or phrases. We ask again and again questions like, is that a tree? Can you say tree? He probably thinks this is ridiculous, and he might be right. Rachel Mayberry of the University of California, San Diego, says our lessons probably aren't needed. All it takes for a young child to learn a language is to be surrounded by people using it.
Children themselves, in an unconscious process that we don't quite understand, are able to, through this barrage of talk that they hear, to figure out the grammar of language.
But this magic window of language learning only stays open for so long. Rachel scans the brains of language learners and says certain areas seem evolved to process grammar. But if they aren't used by age 9 or 10, they start to shut down.
Although they're specialized for language, we see that for them to become fully operational or fully functional or fully wired, so to speak, that actually requires this early stimulation.
Still, for adult first-time language learners, the brain finds a way. It recruits other parts of the brain that normally process space and visual information to work double duty as language areas. These late language learners usually don't or possibly can't use complex sentence structure or abstract vocabulary. They would probably never use a sentence like this one that has a dependent clause, or use a word like linguistics. But Rachel says they do have some advantages. When a child like my son Ari is first learning a word, say, hot, he's learning both the word and the concept at the same time. Adult learners already know the concepts, so they can pick up vocabulary really quickly.
There is this recognition of, oh my gosh, everything has a name. Oh my gosh, I can put these concepts together. So teaching language and learning language for these deaf individuals who are learning language late is a very important and life-changing event for them.
In the sign language class in Kansas City, the more advanced students practice their new language skills by telling stories. Most are in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, but this is the first time they've been able to tell others about many of the heartbreaking experiences they lived through.
It was so hard, so painful, and so hard to trek through the mountains. There was cold and snow. You couldn't walk on the snow because you could fall and be killed.
Men would stand in the forest and hide, and they would say, come in here, come in here. They wanted to rape the women, and we would say, no, no, and run away. We were so afraid because they wanted to rape us and then kill us.
In the refugee camps, we had all these tents, and the elephants would come in at night hungry. The elephants crossed people's heads and stepped on their bodies and tore their bodies apart.
Cobras would come in into camp, and it was scary. See, I was a little girl. I grew up in the refugee camp. I didn't even know there was another place other than this camp.
As Debbie watches her students sign, she slowly shakes her head and tells them, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
I'm happy that you are here safe. I'm happy.
She wants her new students to eventually use their new language skills beyond the classroom. So she takes them on field trips, like a recent trip to the grocery store.
Come on, let's go in.
Let's go.
The class steps past the automatic sliding doors, and they look stunned by the aisles of bright food packaging, the bins of fresh produce, and the rush of lunchtime shoppers. Many of them spend all day inside their apartments, so an outing like this is a big deal. The new student, Dow, stares nervously at the ground.
Honeydew melon, where? I'm looking, she said, I'm looking.
Debbie sends her students on a scavenger hunt to find certain foods and learn their names. They seem to light up as they come across familiar foods like yucca root that they knew from Bhutan and Nepal.
That's cantaloupe.
Their excitement about learning is obvious, but Debbie says it doesn't always translate to new language skills. Because they're late to language learning, sometimes the lessons just don't stick. Some of the class members can go for months without any progress. Others never seem to get it.
It's so discouraging that I, at times, get angry. And I don't know who to be angry at. It's like every human being that is born in this world has this right to be able to express their wants and their needs. And when I work with people that can't express it, I get very frustrated. They found salad dressing. I'm so happy.
But she's always looking for signs of hope. And on this field trip, Dow shows promise. Something seems to have clicked for this woman who seemed so lost. Within an hour, she's practically chasing her teacher through the aisles, pointing and demanding to know the names for things like melons, cabbage, and carrots. What's more amazing is she's signing the names back. Suddenly, it's not hard to imagine her shopping at a place like this on her own and finding her place in this community. Debbie says she recognizes teaching Dow and other class members may take years, and even then, they may never have real fluency. But that's not the point of the classes.
No matter what statistics say, I know that they're out there and I understand all that, but I believe in not giving up, and I believe in giving them something that they can use to have a voice in this world.
For now, Debbie and her students are taking on new language one class at a time.
KCUR's Alex Smith brought us that story. And the people he introduced us to, the ones learning sign language, faced persecution in their home countries that kept them from learning to communicate through language before now, which is totally mind-boggling, but the U.S. has its own history of discrimination when it comes to the non-hearing population. The sign language teacher we just met has a personal perspective on that history, which we're going to hear about now. Reverend Debbie Buchholz, good morning.
Good morning.
You grew up with this history in your home.
I did. My parents are deaf, and aunts, uncles, cousins, children. We have hereditary deafness in our family. Only 13% of deafness is hereditary, and we have hereditary deafness in our family.
And you yourself, you obviously can hear, but you struggle with it a little bit yourself. We're sitting positioned so that you can see my mouth while we're talking.
Yes, I'm hard of hearing. I carry the gene that my family has. And I am hard of hearing. I have severe word discrimination. I can hear sounds easier than I can understanding speech. So I am a lip reader. Yes.
Did discrimination and inequality shape your parents' experience of deafness? In any way that you could witness in your house or heard about from them?
Well, actually, I grew up hearing stories from my parents for many years, all of us, all five of us kids. And my parents had so many stories that they told about what had happened to them at the deaf school, what it was like for them to grow up in families who didn't use sign language in the home. And
wait, can you explain that? Why weren't they using sign language in the home?
So my father's parents were German speaking only. And during that era, my father's born in 1925, deafness here, even in the United States, was considered a curse. It was considered something very negative. The family had sinned, and so this child is born deaf. And so sign language wasn't a beautiful thing during that time, and to have a deaf child was not something you were proud of.
So the idea being that it was that making that invisible was important?
Was very important. My father would tell stories about people coming to the family farm to visit, and he would see one of his parents running at him to grab him and his deaf brother and put them in a closet to hide them. He said he didn't have a clock. He didn't know exactly how long he was stuck in that closet, but he said it was hours and hours, and he does remember sleeping overnight in that closet.
The deaf school that you mentioned that your parents went to, that yeah. You heard stories from there, what kinds of stories came from that experience?
So many stories. During the time that my father, my mother too, she was born in 1935, so there was a 10-year gap there. They entered the school during those years. They had what was called an oral method of education. And so the teachers were not allowed to use sign language, and the students, they could be hard of hearing to profoundly deaf, had to sit and receive the lesson by watching the teachers' mouths. And so he would tell stories about how both my parents loved learning and loved education and had dreams of going to college. Neither one of them did. But he would tell stories about how if they were caught signing, their hands were beaten, they had to kneel on broomsticks, what kind of tools were used in their mouths in speech class, trying to get them to be able to speak. And my father is profoundly deaf. He has zero hearing. And so speaking was not something that he was able to do.
Is hearing stories like this part of what inspires you to work with people whose own inability to hear has in some way shut them out?
Definitely. I spent my whole life, since I have hearing and I'm the eldest daughter, I was ordained the family interpreter. And so I had to interpret for my parents to the whole world and for the world to my parents. And so I went with them through all of the experiences that they had that were related to discrimination and oppression. And I'm different now. In my 20s, I was very angry and on every protest committee out there. But today,
protest committees, like, there are movements,
yes,
in this country. There have been,
yeah,
fighting the kind of discrimination you're talking about.
Yes. And, well, for example, just trying to fight the world in looking at my parents and my aunts and uncles and my cousins in the deaf community, fighting the world to get them to look at them as equals, as people who have a right to have a voice, to express themselves, to receive a proper education, to be able to get married and have a family, or go to college, or to have what everyone else has. It was that kind of fight that I have been involved in my whole life.
What's your understanding of how the kinds of experiences your parents had and your aunts and uncles and so much of your family over time has, what that has to do with history with a capital H in the United States? Do you think that what your parents have experienced represents policy issues or major chapters in history that the hearing community doesn't know very much about?
Well, I think there's a lot. I think that as time goes by, when we're doing all of this fighting, when a minority group is doing all this fighting, trying to get the world to listen to us, trying to find a voice in society, it influences a lot of different areas: education, laws, policies, rights. And I think that it is important for minority groups to continue to fight and to be a voice in the world, and because it does influence history and it does shape our future.
Can you give me an example? You talked about being in your 20s and being out there in protest groups. Can you give me an example of something specific you were protesting at one point?
Yeah, I was involved in a lot of protests in fighting for equal opportunity for education. I grew up hearing these stories from my parents on how they were mistreated, how they were denied, how I have a story of my father who talked about going to college. And when it was time for him to graduate, he was 20 years old, and he was a star student. And
in spite of having to lip read.
In spite of having to lip read, yes. Well, he was a star on the football team and a captain and homecoming king. Right, in spite of. And he wanted to graduate and go to college. And when it was time to graduate, he was told that he wasn't going to graduate. And they never told him why. And I listened to that story throughout my whole childhood. And when my son Noah was deaf, and we moved to this deaf school so that he could attend this school, I asked the superintendent if he could investigate it, and he did. They found his records in the attic, and stamped on the first page was denied graduation because he couldn't speak. And so when they found those records, he was 68 years old, and they gave him his diploma, which was nice, but it did not give him the opportunity to go to college, not at 68.
Yeah, it didn't go back and erase all of those years.
No, it did not.
When you were out there fighting, what were you fighting for specifically?
Specifically to make sure that the teachers who were teaching our deaf children were fluent in American Sign Language, that they understood deaf culture, that a deaf child could go to school and learn something and grow and be educated properly so that they can go to college if they want to.
Debbie Buchholz, stay with me, okay?
Okay.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from an expert on the history of the deaf community's struggle for equal rights. That's coming right up. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're getting a window into a movement for equal rights in this country that a lot of us don't know much about, rights for people with deafness. It turns out there is a whole history there, and we're going to talk about it now with William Ennis. He's a professor of history at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and he himself is deaf, so you'll hear a bit of a lag for an interpreter between my questions and his answers. Hi, William.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What interests you about the history of deaf people in the United States?
That's a good question. Both of my parents were deaf. I'm from a deaf family. And my father was very into history generally, and I think that really touched me. And I was participating, listening to your conversation with Debbie, and it was interesting to me the difference between her experience and mine. I'm from a deaf family, big deaf family, and both of my parents went to college. My mother went to graduate school. So our experience was very different in that, and the stories that she got and that I got were very different. So you can see how much education can actually have an impact on deaf lives, and it's really critical. And I thank Debbie for all of her advocacy and protest work. It's really important.
You know, when it comes to this history, it seems like it's hard to avoid the name Alexander Graham Bell, who most of us know as the inventor of the telephone, which sounds innocent enough. But what was Alexander Graham Bell's relationship with the deaf community?
So he not only invented the telephone, but he had a very interest and involvement. He was a strong supporter of oralism. And not only oralism, but also eugenics. And my research looked at how those two really overlapped. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but there is some overlap in how they had an influence on one another. So at the beginning of deaf education in the United States in roughly 1817, sign language was accepted, it was appreciated, and used in all schools in America. And it wasn't until about 1840 or 1850 that oralism actually emerged, and that also kind of coincided with the eugenics movement. And the two of them would then kind of feed each other to really oppress deaf education in the sense of banning sign language.
Why was Alexander Graham Bell concerned about this?
His family had a history of, at that time it was called elocutionist. So his grandfather in Scotland and Britain worked in that field. So it was somewhat natural that he would be involved in that as well. So he had always been focused on speech and how we learn speech and writing system of learning how to speak appropriately. So it wasn't surprising that he was involved.
The word eugenics is probably familiar to a lot of our listeners, but oralism maybe not. Can you explain that word and that movement?
Sure. So generally speaking, there are two types of education for deaf children. One uses sign language, and the other is oralism. That basically means using speech and training deaf children to speak, physically speak, and to speech read. And that's historical model and has evolved somewhat with the advances of technology, cochlear implants, and that's helped that model somewhat. But generally in history, there are those two options. And where oralism and eugenics intersect is that sense of normalcy. Attempting or pushing so everything you can do to make a deaf person fit back into hearing society.
How is that harmful to deaf people?
The deaf community, the deaf world would argue that deaf culture is a part of the inherent, it's an inherent part of a person. Signing is a natural way for deaf people to speak. And for everything from that language of sign through the culture, the traditions, is all intertwined. For us, normalcy means signing and being visual. Forcing deaf people to use, or, well, first of all, to set aside their sign language and accept speech and lip reading, that forces or that pressure to fit into normalcy has a long history of oppression, and not just for deaf people. You can look at African Americans who would pass as white. You can see other disabled groups who can pretend or pass as though they're not disabled. So that oppression exists, and deaf people have experienced it for quite some time.
How have oralism and eugenics been codified into law or other institutions in this country?
The first eugenics law in America was in 1907 in Indiana, and it was a sterilization law. And from that point on, I think our last law that was on the books was in, I may be wrong with the specifics, but it went first quite well into the 20th century. And those laws, most of the time, were pretty broad, which then left room for including almost anybody that didn't fit whatever normalcy was defined at the time.
Can you explain what you referred to as a sterilization law?
So the law in Indiana, for example, most of the time applied to inmates, prisoners, and they would be sterilized. As it applied to deaf people or other groups, the sterilization intent was to prevent offspring. So Bell, going back to Alexander Graham Bell, he pushed for a marriage law that would ban deaf people from marrying one another, because at that time it was felt if two deaf people married, they would have deaf offspring. Now, the science doesn't necessarily fit that reality, what was seen, but most, because 95% of deaf people have hearing parents, but that was the pressure at the time.
How have laws like that been removed or repealed? Have there been like heroes in a struggle for equality that we should be knowing about and celebrating?
I don't know if there were heroes, because you have to remember that the target of these laws were people on the margins of society. One example of a deaf situation, a guy named Junius Winston. He was a deaf black man in North Carolina who was to be sterilized. And that's almost like two strikes against him. One, he was deaf, and he was black, and third, he was poor. Mm. So there's not a lot of hero stories here. A lot of people who were targeted were also had mental issues. So society generally didn't recognize them as heroes, but states like California, Virginia, North Carolina, all of those state legislatures have apologize to those who were harmed during those periods and made some reparations in some cases.
Who has done the pushing for those reparations?
So a lot, I mean, that's a good question, and I'm not exactly sure, but a lot has been from within, but different groups like historical groups and individuals themselves. Junius Winston, for example, lived his whole life in an institution, and his case just so happened to be found by an attorney, and that attorney chased it to freeing him from that institution. By the time it happened, he was in his 70s and couldn't really leave the institution anyway. So yeah.
Well, I have read about a pretty significant movement around deaf people pushing for the right to take the civil service exam. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that was in the early part of the 20th century. And the largest employer of deaf people today is the federal government. And at some point, the government decided to not allow people to take the civil service exam. You had to be able to hear to take the exam. And through the National Association of the Deaf, our NAACP, so to speak, they fought to have that law or rule repealed, and that the Teddy Roosevelt was the president at the time who supported that removal and allow deaf people to take the exam.
What did that victory represent to the deaf community? It seems like an important milestone.
Employment, absolutely. And that's what most deaf people wanted. They wanted employment was key. Today, probably the largest group of unemployed people are people with disabilities in general. If I remember the numbers right, only about 10% of people with disabilities in America have a job. 90% are unemployed, but could work with appropriate accommodations.
I want to turn back to Debbie Buchholz on both the history we've been hearing about, but also the future for this struggle for rights. She's, as you'll recall, the co-founder of Deaf International. She's also the pastor at Deaf International Community Church. And she talked to us earlier about growing up with deaf parents. Her son is also deaf. And Debbie, how are things different for your son than they were for your parents?
So much difference. My son graduated, received a bachelor's degree. He received a master's degree. He's studying now for a second master's degree and wants to pursue a PhD. And so opportunities have opened up so much more than when my father was younger. And so it's not over though. I just want to make that clear. In my opinion, it's not over. I believe that people in the minority will have to fight probably for the rest of their life, but that it's critical not to give up, but to keep fighting, because everyone has a right to receive the same things. And so it's important for people to realize that this is, it's not over. Even though it's better, it's not over.
Tell me how you and your son are still fighting today.
Well, mostly, again, education. And like the professor mentioned, job opportunities. There's so many deaf people that want to work. So many deaf people who are criticized for not having a job. And they're actually looking and they're applying within and they're being turned down because just that piece of being deaf scares employers. And so they want to work and they are looking for positions. And if the accommodations were right and proper, they would all be able to work.
Reverend Debbie Buchholz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And William Ennis, historian with us from Gallaudet University, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back with a guy who calls himself the Ambassador of Americana. Charles Phoenix has been traveling the country giving slideshows using found slides from thrift stores for years. He's taking his audiences on a trip, but they're not going to another place. They're going to another time, the 1950s and 1960s. Charles is our next guest on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, so Okay, I've been reading your book. You have a book called Addicted to Americana, and I happen to know that this all began for you on a car lot. So let's start there. Can you tell us about your upbringing in a car lot?
Yes, my addiction to Americana definitely did start. I was born on a used car lot. I mean, not literally, but I came home from the hospital and went to my dad's workplace, which he owned a used car lot in Ontario, California, which is Southern California. And then we went to Disneyland. So immediately I opened my eyes up to like these, when I was a little kid, the cars all had big tail fins on the used car lot. And I was like, wow, I am interested in all of, to learn all about this. And then going to Disneyland, I got this whole education with, you know, style and design and eras and all this other kind of stuff. So it was kind of born on a used car lot, raised at Disneyland, and, you know, a little bit of shopping malls thrown in there. And then as an adolescent, I discovered thrift shops. And I discovered them as the underbelly of our mass consumerism culture, museums of merchandise, and the perfect place for me to study, you know, consumerism. And everything was vintage. So I just, I have this eye for the vintage. And, you know, so currently what I do is I collect other people's old Kodachrome slides. And I've been traveling the country doing these retro slideshows. But over the last few years, the slideshows have evolved from being just about the vintage images to me going in search of things that I find in these images, including something that was a spectacular find that's featured in the book, your constellation, your TWA constellation at the Airline History Museum in Kansas City, and the moon and the TWA Moonliner rocket that's there. There's a whole story that goes along with discovering that it's there and blah, blah, blah.
Can you tell that story for our listeners who don't know it?
Well, yeah, basically the story is pretty simple. So growing up at Disneyland, you know, I became enamored with Tomorrowland, was one of my favorite lands, if not my favorite. And even before my time in Tomorrowland, there was a big TWA-branded rocket ship, a rocket ship of the future. This is in the 1950s and early 60s. And they made two of them back in the day. They made one for Disneyland's Tomorrowland, and they made one to go on the roof of the TWA headquarters in Kansas City. So in Kansas City, starting in 1956, I think, there was a rocket ship on the roof of TWA headquarters. And they got rid of it in 64 when TWA headquarters moved to New York. And it went to a location that I found out only a couple of years ago was a RV manufacturing facility somewhere in rural Kansas City, this rocket ship. So, and it's big. I mean, it's, you know, Disneyland scale. It's huge. So I decided I had to go find it. I thought, I'm going to play detective and I'm going to find that motorhome. So it's no fun to go online and just, you know, Google where something is. I mean, now you can do that. But this was actually a few years ago when it wasn't so easy. But anyway, so I go to Kansas City. I fly in. I get my rent-a-car. I'm driving out of the airport. And out of the corner of my eye, I see a giant TWA Constellation airplane, which is an airplane, the one with three tails. It was the most glamorous way to fly before the jet age in 1959. So it's a relic of the mid-century era. And you guys in Kansas City have the best remaining example on the planet. And I see it sitting out on the tarmac. And I'm like, what's that doing there? And I pull over. Turns out I'm at the Airline History Museum, which is amazing, by the way. So I look at the Constellation and I tell the docent inside the Constellation, you know, I'm in a hurry because I got to go find this TWA Moonliner. And she says, oh, you should just come around and look inside the museum. The airplane was kind of on the backside. And she says, I think there's something in there that you want to see. And I'm like, I'm gonna come back tomorrow because I'm really a man on a mission and I got to go see this, find this TWA Moonliner. So anyway, so she says, no, I insist, you got to come in now, please. So I walk around the front and there it is, the TWA Moonliner at the entrance of the Airline History Museum. I said, where'd you get that? She said, oh, we just got it from the RV manufacturing facility.
So crazy.
I know. There's stuff everywhere. There are artifacts and treasures. I always call them time warps and treasures, and that's what I'm going in search of. And that is in large part what this book is about. This is a celebration of American culture. And, you know, there was a pop cultural explosion that happened in the mid-century era that was unlike anything the world had ever known before. And, you know, it's really incredible if you look back and see what we produced and the style and the quality in which it was produced in. It's really incredible. And we were such a consumerism society, as we still are. We just, like, you know, kind of threw everything away. And, you know, it was out of style or whatever. Or it broke or whatever. And, you know, threw it in the garbage or left it out behind the barn to rot.
Does this time period and all this stuff that sort of lives on to tell us about it, does it look different in different parts of the country? Because you do, you seem to travel and not just look for things like in airline history museums, but also you're still digging up these slides in thrift stores, not just in California, all over the place.
Well, yeah. I mean, I always say the world is a wonderland to discover. There's something interesting around every corner, no matter where you go. I mean, especially the United States, and especially if you're interested in mid-century pop culture, as I am. So I'm always in search of time warps and treasures wherever I go, whatever city I'm in. And there is stuff left everywhere. And there is stuff in public collections and private collections. And then there's the stuff in the wild that's still going. That's still working. Like in Kansas City, there's a couple of places that I'm going to be there in a couple of days to do my Addicted to Americana slideshow there. But I'm going to go to Town Topic. That's downtown, the little diner with the neon sign. There's another place. I'm not exactly sure where it is. It might be in the burbs, but it's called Fritz's. And it's a railroad-themed diner where they deliver your lunch or dinner or breakfast or whatever it is on a little choo-choo train. I mean, you know, I love stuff like that. I also go in search of, you know, great cultural institutions and kind of want to put them on a pedestal too, such as, in your case, Hallmark, which is a very, very underrated cultural a cultural icon, an institution that's hardly gotten any credit for all that it contributed to our culture.
What would you say it contributed to our culture?
Well, I mean, so much. I mean, where do we begin? I mean, it taught us how to greet people, you know, through a little card and all the artwork and just the products that they made. It's such a huge, huge, huge piece of American pop culture. Hallmark is, you know, it's not an institution that ever really drew attention to its accomplishments, unlike a Disneyland, another artistic institution that really, you know, is all about selling themselves. Hallmark is so demure in their approach to patting themselves on the back for all that they've done over the last, you know, 100 years. But it's major. I mean, it is major. People in the future are going to have such a field day with the mid-century culture in the United States is just, you know, over the top, outrageous. Look at the cars. I mean, the cars, like a 59 Cadillac looks like a car and a rocket ship had a baby. I mean, it's insane.
Wait, there are pictures of you throughout this book kind of, if you don't mind my saying so, like hamming it up with, you know, the giant fiberglass mascots at theme parks and national parks and just all over the place, or at Disneyland at, was it Dapper Night or
Dapper Day?
Dapper Day, excuse me.
That's,
but
yeah.
I'm just trying to, it sounds like you genuinely have a lot of love and feel like, you know, these relics need to be appreciated in a way they haven't been. But is there some level of also laughing at some of these things or
never,
no?
Never, 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 never. We're laughing with. We're never laughing at. This is total respect, what I do. It is serious, and it's from the heart, and it's my life's work. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help us as Americans realize part of what's special about our culture. This isn't everything about all of our culture, and I'm not celebrating the mid-century era as everything perfect, but I'm plucking out things and I'm going in search of it, and I'm looking for greatness. And when I find it, I know what I'm looking for, and I know what I find when I find it. And this is all respect. This is a tribute to us and to the people who were there and created it and made it happen, and to hopefully further ensure that future generations will be able to understand and appreciate this very exuberant and playful era of American style and design.
You know,
so it's very serious.
When you talk about the thrift store being the museum of American culture and American consumerism, and that you're looking for greatness and you know when you found it, can you give an example of something you have found in a thrift store that has said to you, it has just immediately said, this is greatness right here?
Yeah, well, I grew up, when I was 14, I started thrift shopping. And back then, that was like in 1977, the thrift stores were full of, you know, mid-century stuff. So, I mean, it was just like, they were museums to me. And I looked at every single, I would go into a thrift store and look at everything. And I mean, I would buy a few things, but I would look at everything. You know, I mean, I can't think of one thing specifically that I found that's, you know, something. It's more about what came later. I mean, that was an overview inspiration to me and education. But, you know, you talked about,
the box,
you know, our, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, perhaps. I mean, this will lead us into another subject. But the box of slides, your first box of slides you found in a thrift store. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I was, you know, already into vintage stuff. And then one day I found a box of other people's old slides in a thrift store marked Trip Across the United States, 1957. And I held a few Kodachrome, of these Kodachrome images up, and I was spellbound by what I saw. I mean, each of these slides were, was like a window into another era where I saw all the things that I was enamored with, the vintage cars and the vintage architecture and the clothes the people were wearing and just the reality of it all. And I started collecting in earnest, and I've been collecting other people's old slides for 25 years. I have what I call the slibrary, and I have a slibrarian, and I have been, you know, basically I've built a career on showing these slides and creating theme shows out of them, never laughing with. It's always, you know, there is a lot of humor involved in what I do in my shows, because early on I realized people, this was a thrill for people to see, and they wanted to enjoy it with humor. So never laughing, never laughing at, always laughing with. But there is a lot of humor involved in what I do, especially in my live slideshow performances. And, you know, because I also realized early on that history doesn't have a lot of value in our, in our economy as much as entertainment does. So
can I jump in on that note? I mean, because part of what you're doing is about the content, the things that people will see in these slides that have been cast aside and then rediscovered by you and curated. But there's also the format, just the idea of a vacation slideshow is this sort of vintage idea. And we do something like it when we share trip pictures on social media. But the act of getting together and looking at these slides is, that is a lost tradition. And I wonder what it's like for you and the people who come to your shows to revive that experience.
Well, it's not really reviving it for them. I mean, I've basically, what I've done is I've supercharged the classic living room slideshow into a performance. And it is a theatrical performance, and it's basically, it's the Addicted to Americana slideshow right now, which is based on the book, and that's what I'm doing at the Johnson County Museum this Sunday at 3 p.m. in Kansas City. It's not like sitting at home in your living room with your grandparents watching the slides back in the day. I mean, this is a full performance. We switch subjects a lot, and you know, I'm storytelling the whole time, and there's a lot of humor involved. There's also, because I'm in Kansas City, I'll include vintage Kansas City images, and you know, other places that are of that era that I have found. I'm also going to talk about, I'm really wild about your Steamboat Arabia Museum, which is not exactly mid-century, but
why are you so wild about the Steamboat Arabia Museum?
It's America's greatest time capsule. That's why. There's nothing else like it in the entire world. I'm looking for uniqueness, I'm looking for greatness, and I'm looking to put it up on a pedestal and share it with people in hopes that, you know, what I do will in part enrich their lives and you know, have them, give them something to go see and look at.
Give them a chance to go to their own little thrift store museums.
Well, that and the whole world. It's not just about thrift stores. It's about, there are treasures and time warps around us. And I'm just looking to show what's special and get it out there and celebrate American culture.
Charles Phoenix, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Charles Phoenix will be at the Johnson County Museum of History this Sunday, November 12th, with his Addicted to Americana slideshow. And you can check out his book, Addicted to Americana, Celebrating Classic and kitschy American life and style. That's it for today. You can listen back to our whole show at kcur.org/Central Standard. And tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Atlas Obscura, a project collecting information on the little-known places that are mysterious, quirky, or inspire a sense of disbelief and wonder. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman.